Good morning. I'll start with a Sanskrit chant. Can you all hear me? Okay, it's invoking the presence of Brahman, which, as you can see, is one of the Sanskrit words for God. It is the infinite, all-pervading existence, or what Meister Eckhart would have called the ground of being. So the chant is Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shantihi Shantihi Shantihi. Om. Filled with Brahman are the things we see. Filled with Brahman are the things we see not. From out of Brahman floweth all that is. From Brahman floweth all, yet is he still the same. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto us all. Good morning, and thank you for that lovely blessing. And it's wonderful to come into a place where we start out with the assumption that we are holy people. That is the most important step that we can make in spiritual life. It's to not come from a place of weakness, but to come from a place of the recognition that we are the children of God, that we are in ourselves whole and complete. One of the basic thoughts in the Hindu tradition, it's very important to keep this in mind whenever you hear a Hindu talking, is that we believe that the real soul within us, or what in Sanskrit is called the Atman, is pure, perfect, and eternal. And that is the real us. In the Western tradition, you have this kind of bifurcation between the body and the mind. Well, is it the body or is it the mind? How does the body affect the mind and vice versa? So you have this two-part division in the Western tradition. In the Eastern traditions, they think of it in terms of three. The very core of our being, or what is called the Atman, is one with God. Pure, perfect, and eternal. It's never born. It's never dying. It is always one with the infinite God. Outside of that, you can think of it as a nut, is the mind. And over that is the body. So the realest part of us, according to the Hindu tradition, is God. It's that divine portion within ourselves that we often don't recognize. So whenever, I just want to get that straight before I say anything else, which is, God knows. I was listening to that introduction. I go, who would do that? I spend a lot of my time just cleaning the house and doing toilets and floors. Like everybody else. So, first of all, Vedanta and Hinduism. People will look at me and say, God, you don't look like a Hindu. You need, in front of friends, say, don't you need to have more arms? What a help that I'm doing the floors. And that's because there's sort of a misunderstanding of the Hindu tradition. Hinduism has thousands of different sects and forms. Vedanta is one of the underlying philosophies. There are six major philosophies of Hinduism. I won't bore you with telling about them all. But one of the probably the strongest, most prevalent philosophy is that of Vedanta, which comes from two words, Veda and Anta. Veda is not only the scriptures, the holy scriptures, but it comes from the word vid, to know. So it's that revealed truth of God, which is available to every human being, the revealed truth of the divine, combined with anta, which is the end of or the goal of. So what is the goal of knowledge? Self-knowledge. Because when you really know yourself, when we really know ourselves, it's knowledge of the divine. So Vedanta, is all about getting to know ourselves in the deepest possible way, which is connecting to the divinity that lies within our hearts, in the hearts of every being, but is most manifest in the human heart. I really enjoyed this book a lot. And when I was reading Nolan's book, I thought, right, yes, yeah, he's got it. He's totally got it, because he understands he's coming from that deep place of contemplation. And that's where we find the truth of God, is within our own hearts. It's not listening to what someone said a few hundred years ago, that this is really what God meant. It has to resonate in our own hearts, or else we're just following laws. We're following the rule book. When we get into following the rule book and thinking that God is all about, 10 times, 9 times I did this, but the other one time, and God's not up there, and that's what Jesus brought to the world. Why would a Hindu nun find anything interesting in the words of Jesus? Because Jesus is absolutely as true and applicable to today as he was 2,000 years ago. Because the words that he spoke were truth. And he came from that deep place of being with Abba, the Father. The thing is that when you think about it without the cultural background, I was raised as part Hindu, part Episcopalian. My parents decided they wanted to sort of have a normal child, which is a joke. So they would send me to Sunday school, Episcopalian Sunday school, and then I would come back and say, Mom, if God is love, then how can he send people to hell? And she said, oh, honey, we don't believe in hell. We believe in reincarnation. Why do you send me Sunday school? Conflicting messages. But you see, so we're all raised with this tradition where we're understood that Jesus is, has something important to say. But why? Let's say if you walked in here and you were from some part of the world where you'd never heard of Jesus, why would Jesus' words be important today? He was a peasant. He didn't try to attract attention to himself to just get name and fame. The princes, the kings, the queens, the noblemen, the people who had money and the power, no one knows who they are today except by their tangential association with Jesus. Jesus is important today because he lived a life of God, because he recognized that Abba was divine Father. And by connecting with that, by connecting with truth, he could find life eternal for the entire world. As important today as it was 2,000 years ago. So where the people who tried to go for name and fame and power and money, they're gone. They're forgotten. Whereas the man who died a humiliating death, who lived as birds do, who never knew where the day would follow the next, lives on in immortality, as he will, because he only sought the will of divine. I loved so much the idea of the radical freedom that Nolan talks about. Because in our culture, we're sort of brought to believe in the Marlboro Man myth. Mm-hmm. I want to be free. I'm going to get in my car and I'm going to get up and I'm going to do what I want. And that is about the most slavish thing that we can possibly do. Because what we're really doing is just succumbing to our own self-centered desires. The American idea of freedom is I want to do what I want, when I want, and if anyone stands in my way, I'm going to move them. I mean, how many movies have we seen that are all about that? It's the rebel. It's like, I'm going to do this because I want to do it. And I'll go off to Vegas and I'll get drunk, and who are you to tell me what to do? This is freedom. This is a miserable life. It's being a slave to our petty, small, self-centered desires. And this is everything that Jesus Christ stood against. He could have gotten off that cross in a minute, but he wanted to do the will of the Father. Giving up the ego, which is what Nolan gets to right away, it's that toxic ego that we confuse with who we really are. The toxic ego is the thing that says, me first. I, me, mine. What I want is the most important, and the hell with everybody else. Whereas Jesus understood that the real source of all of our pain is our self-centered desire. So when we give up are the desires that make us less generous than we should be, less loving than we should be, less kind than we should be, we are entrapping ourselves into a life of hell. Because if you've ever seen people that want to do, that insist on doing what they want to do all the time, you see that they're the most miserable people on earth. The happiest people are not the ones with the most money. They're the ones who are content. They're the ones who find joy in the small things that we all share. It's going down to the beach. It's going out and seeing the sunrise. It's having a moment of giving without expecting a thing in return. That is what Jesus offers us. It's the offering of being able to pull into ourselves and living a life of total self-abnegation, with only wanting what Abba wants. I'm very lucky that I was paired with two chapters that are so completely aligned. The first one, spirituality of healing, and the second one, in silence and solitude. Because you can't have healing, according to the Hindu tradition, unless you first go into silence and solitude. Because what are we really talking about when we're talking about healing? That's what I find a very interesting thing, because when we talk about healing, what is it that isn't whole? Now, what I found interesting is that no one said that Jesus didn't see sin and guilt. What he saw was woundedness, brokenness, sickness, confusion, and fear. So what does this mean? Or another way of saying this is, Jesus cleansed a leper. What does this mean for us now? The point isn't for us to say, okay, I swear I believe that he cleansed a leper. I swear I believe he brought people, that he brought people sight. That does not help us today. What helps us is the real healing that Jesus did. And when I was thinking about this, I thought, what can I really think of what this healing is all about? And then I remember this wonderful quotation from Houston Smith, who is widely considered the world's authority on living religions today. And Houston said, "We're all born with a God-shaped hole in our hearts. And the only thing to fill that hole is God. And the tragedy is that we go about it in entirely the wrong way. We all, in some way, feel this lack, this disconnectedness, this sense of not being complete. Every romance movie that you see today, you'll see the girl going, 'I need you to make me whole.' No, baby. You are so wrong. Because if you walk into that relationship thinking that someone else is going to make you whole, you are going to make him so miserable, because you're going to be needy. And that is what radical freedom is all about. Radical freedom is being freedom in the knowledge that God alone is our only resource, it's the only reality, and God alone is that which completes us. It makes you free from any desire, any neediness, any sense that I will be happy if only I have that. I will be happy. Nothing makes us happy except for the knowledge of God dwelling in our hearts. And that can only be found in silence and in solitude. In silence and in solitude, in the deep cave of our hearts, we find the indwelling presence of God. And from that fullness, that's why I chose that prayer, filled with Brahman, Purna. Purna means fullness. From that fullness of God in our own hearts, we go out to the world knowing that we don't need anything, that we are complete and full in ourselves. So you say, yeah, okay, You guys say that we're full and complete. You guys say that, you know, we're intrinsically divine. Well, how come I don't feel particularly divine when I wake up in the morning and I'm positively evil until I get a cup of coffee? It's because of what the Hindu tradition calls Maya, which is illusion or delusion. The cosmic magician, our cosmic sense of amnesia, that we don't know who we really are. What the great mystics of the world do, what Jesus Christ does, it says, forget this. Forget everything that you think is real. Only God is real. Only the human beings in front of you, in their divinity lying in their hearts, that is real. All this stuff, the money, and the rich young man who could not give up. Why didn't he give up all he had to follow Jesus? How stupid does that seem to us now? He couldn't, because of the veil of ignorance, because his attachment, his desire was so strong. He thought that the money was going to make him happy. If he had only realized that the kingdom of God was within him and that Jesus was offering him the vision of how to get there, how much happier would he have been? Even if he had died a martyr's death, would he had not have been fulfilled? The money would not have fulfilled him. So this God-shaped hole in our hearts, we would say, is actually an illusion. But we feel that. We feel that because of this cosmic amnesia, which we call Maya. So all of spiritual practice is not to become something other than we are. We're not trying to become a saint. We're not trying to be pious and holy so that we can really do this on the outside and be different on the inside. We're only one person. Everything about our lives has to be completely integrated. We have to be the same person Sunday at 11 o'clock as we are Monday at 7:30. Because we're only one spiritual human being, holy people, starting from the inside out. And that's why spirituality is always connected to wholeness and healing in silence and solitude first, then moves from inside out into healing. Why would Jesus raise Lazarus? That intrigued me for years. Why would Jesus raise a man from the dead who's only going to die again? I mean, really, all of us are going to die again. Why would he heal someone if they're just going to get sick again? Because the process wasn't really about the body. It was really about the inner soul of the person. Lazarus was not only dead in the body. Anyone who suffers from the ego is dead. And Nolan brings that out so beautifully. That when we are trapped in our ego, when we're not willing to do what Christ could do, which is to give his life for others, then we're dead. When we're trapped in that cosmic, that sense of that toxic ego, we can't feel or be aware of anything else apart from our own limited desires in mind. We cannot love our neighbors as ourselves if all we can see is what I want. Me, I, first. We cannot love our neighbor as ourselves. We cannot even begin to love God until we try to make God come first in our lives. And that has to come first in silence and solitude, in our spiritual practice. The Hindu tradition placed great importance on silence and solitude, even if it's for a few minutes a day. But inside, where we can kind of charge our batteries, where any little place in the house, any place that's just yours, where you connect, where we all connect to that deepest portion of ourselves, where we try to remember the presence of God, that illuminating, luminous portion of ourselves where the presence of God is. Jesus Christ said, I and my Father are one. This isn't just for Jesus Christ. This is for all of us. This isn't just about the historical Jesus. So it was only about the historical Jesus, he wouldn't be important today. I mean, it's nice to know, you know, what Bethlehem was like or what the Sea of Galilee was like, but it's not really relevant. What's really relevant is how Christ speaks to us today. So he was not talking as a historical being, I and my Father one, and you have to believe that and you better be happy with that. It's about how we have to be mystics ourselves and realize God within our own hearts and have that living presence become the most important part of our lives. That we can check any minute, and when life becomes too much, when you're overcome by grief or despair, that we can remember that God is in our own hearts and God is guiding us, and nothing happens except by the blessing and loving hand of God. If Christ is willing to suffer an ignominious death, why can't we be willing to stop at a stop sign? I mean, why do we think that it's all in history and not applying to our lives today? If Christ can have that sort of lack of ego, where he can give his life, can't we practice a little generosity and kindness ourselves? There cannot be a disconnect between our spiritual life and what we say Jesus stood for and our own very simple actions of letting maybe someone go first in line, or maybe not getting angry and impatient when someone says something hurtful, or not responding in anger or a hurtful word, even though it would be satisfying. Because in the long run, it just creates an unhappy mind. An unhappy mind creates a life of misery for ourselves. Imitating the life of Jesus means, first of all, that life in ourselves, that deepest part of our life. I have a little bone to pick with Mr. Nolan, which I'll tell you about right now. When we Hindus talk about a contemplative life, because we say the realest part of ourselves is that divine portion in ourselves. Well, how do we make this more real? How do we take this philosophy and make this real? Well, we say we go into silence and solitude and we practice meditation. Now, Albert Nolan says, the mantra or sacred word we choose does not have to be particularly meaningful. Baloney. Baloney. He says a mantra or sacred word is by definition holy. If it's a holy word, it's meaningful. If you say, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, that is important. It's meaningful. So if you say, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee, that's very important. It's very meaningful. If you say, Abba, Abba, that is deeply meaningful. So don't meditate on something that's not one, one, one. What kind of nonsense is that? Om is not a throwaway symbol. It's a very important holy symbol. It's believed to be all the sounds of the universe. All the vowels go into ah, and all the consonants compress into the mm. It takes up every portion of your mouth, starting from the open portion in the middle, going through the front part, closing in the front part. The idea that sacred sound is sacred. It elevates our mind. Hello, John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Hello, this is meaningful. If you notice how much garbage goes around in our minds, I mean, when you're just sitting and doing nothing, you have what? What do you go through your minds? Think, I got to do this. Why didn't I tell her that? I shouldn't have told her that. Or commercials. Brushy, 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 brushy with a pen. Hello. I date myself, don't I? I mean, I remember rock and roll songs from 1964. Why don't we put, instead of garbage in our minds, have the name of God going through our minds? So the mantra is not a meaningless symbol. It is the name of God. So whatever name we use, whatever name we want to put into our minds, it should be a holy name that raises our minds so that we think of God. So that when we say this to ourselves, when we go for a walk, you don't have to tune into an iPod. You don't have to, you can just repeat the name of God. And remember that in our deepest core of our being, we are divine. No one is absolutely right on when he talks about this addiction that we have to busyness. And I'm wondering, we're all kind of on email all the time, and a lot of people aren't comfortable unless they have their cell phone here, and they have to have their cell phone on all the time. And you walk in the house, you see them, the first thing they go on is the television goes on, and then the radio goes on, and they're checking the news, and they're flipping the channels. It's like, I really wonder, are we doing this to avoid silence? Are we doing this because we're uncomfortable? Are we afraid that if we stop this frenetic addiction to activity, that first of all, we might feel useless? Are we thinking that if we're not busy all the time, we are somehow lesser than people who have to, take calls? I wonder, or is it we're afraid of the contents of our own minds? And this is what I'd like to explore. A friend of mine once said that he found with the Western people that they were actually afraid to be in their minds. That he felt that a lot of them felt like that their own minds were like garbage cans. They sort of had the lids tightly on like that, and if they stopped holding it down for them, it was like, and they would find things in there they couldn't bear to see. So I'm wondering if this is the root of the addiction to having our minds so externalized all the time that we're actually afraid of quiet. And I would like to suggest that maybe this is a possibility, and I'd like to suggest too that maybe it's going about it the wrong way. That our minds are indeed troublesome, that our minds are what they, in the Hindu and Buddhist tradition, they both say the mind is like a drunken monkey stung by a scorpion who has just found himself on a hot griddle. Or you can think of it as the 3-month-old golden lab that just cannot stand still and insists on taking your shoes apart. But when we actually gently lift the lid of the mind, we'll find nothing in there but a bunch of nonsense and a bunch of things that we really need to let go of. The Hindu tradition does not believe in sin. The Hindu tradition believes in mistakes. The Hindu tradition says that everybody is inevitably going towards freedom. Because our real nature is divine, we will inevitably, as part of our birthright of human beings, realize that the kingdom of God is within us. We can't help it. Now, because we believe in karma and reincarnation, karma basically being what ye sow, so shall ye reap, whether it be in this life or another life, because of that, we are all at different stages of evolution spiritually. You will find some people who are kind and generous and loving, and some people who are just mean, greedy, self-centered. These people we would not call sinful. We would say that they're trying, like everybody else, to be happy. They're trying to fill that hole in their heart. And they're doing it in absolutely the wrong way. They're doing it through promiscuous sex, thinking that, well, if I get laid, I'll be happy. I'm happy. No work. They'll think if they rob a bank, they'll get money, and they'll be happy. They think if they get wife number 7, maybe the 7th will be different from the first 6. Or if they have a nice fling, maybe that'll add some little interest. But it leaves you feeling empty. Because all these fulfilling, these small things, make us feel smaller and smaller. And even the murderer Even the murderer thinks, if I get this person out of my way, then I can be happy. If Jesus said, whatever you do to the least of my brethren, doesn't this even include the worst of the worst? The child molester? Isn't that person even acceptable in the eyes of Jesus Christ as the least of his brethren? Now, what we would say is that that person, whatever horrible actions that person did, will cause an effect of action. It causes karma. That person will suffer either in this life or another life. That person will have to suffer whatever hurt that you inflict, either with your body or your mind. Whatever evil thoughts you send out will come back. Whatever thoughts of anger, of jealousy, of meanness, of self-centeredness will come back our way. Not only that, but we also create a mind which is really not a pleasant mind to be in. Because the more angry we are, does the person who's receiving our anger feel worse, or do we feel worse, just like this? When we hate, does the person feel our hatred? Well, they might not even know we're alive. And George Bush, I mean, he gets a lot of hate. Does he care? But what do? If we send out thoughts of hatred, that boomerangs back to us. There are no fly balls. These are all boomerangs. Mm-hmm. We're sending out boomerangs wherever we go because we create what comes back to us in our own minds by creating a mental environment that's absolutely toxic. Jesus Christ loved those who hated him. And he was able to do this because he was centered in Abba. He had the love of God radiating in his heart. So that was able to, that gave him the strength to endure anything, as can we. This isn't just for Jesus. It's our birthright as human beings. So because Hindus believe, as a rule, not all of them, because there's Hinduism being what it is, it's like there is no one book, there is none, there's no one authority who says Hindus believe that, we don't believe it, we don't have any authority. And everyone sort of does their own thing. That's why the traffic is the way it is over there. Everyone does their own thing. Totally chaotic. Many different. But because of that, there's this basic understanding that we're people who are at different stages of spiritual development. Because of that, we do not believe that there's ever going to become a time where it's like, the world's great. No more greedy people. No more selfish people. No more rich and no more poor. Everyone's just fine. Everyone's happy. It ain't going to happen. Mm-hmm. People are at different stages of evolution. Because until we will always have saints in our midst, we will always have kind, loving, generous people. We'll have the Mother Teresa's. We'll have the Dalai Lama's. And then we'll have the child molesters, and we'll have the murderers, and we'll have the people who inflict pain, and they will go around until they realize that their pain is completely self-inflicted. That most of us have not learned from what we've done right, but we've learned from what we've done wrong. Mm-hmm. That most of us, we learn better from our mistakes, and we do better learning from our own suffering. It's like you put your hand in the fire. Ah, I'm not going to do that again. I am never going to do that again. That comes not from having someone pat us on the head and say, that was such a nice thing to do. It's because we've learned the hard way. That life isn't an easy drive over here. Nothing in this world is easy. I was interested. No one wrote, if I can only find it. Lordy. He was talking about how at the time of Jesus, the people that Jesus was with were really enduring, they were an oppressed people. That they were living in poverty. There was a huge amount of mental illness. There was a huge amount of suffering. People were waiting for the Messiah because it was such a terrible time. I've got the quote in here somewhere, but yeah. And as I was reading, I say, how is this different today? Mm-hmm. What makes us think that it was terrible then and it's dandy now? It's not. It's not dandy. There has never been a time on the earth when things have been just hunky-dory. You know, we might have the Berlin Wall fall, but then look what's happening in Kenya today. We might have less leprosy over here, but I sure see a lot of suicide. I'm called to suicide for you know, parents who've lost their children to suicide. I can't believe how much suicide, how much depression, how many people are popping pills because they can't bear to open up the lids of their minds. They've numbed themselves because they just can't deal with the pain of being alive. And the pain of being a human being is really quite terrible if we don't keep in mind that within our hearts lies this treasure of God's presence. Catherine of Genoa said, "My me is God." Well, what a wonderful place to come from. Why? I mean, if we can just remember, my me is God. That deepest portion of me, the portion that gives me the strength and kind and love, is that portion that nothing can take away. No illness, no suffering, no death, no divorce. Nothing can take that deepest portion away from us. My me is God. So what we see now is if we might remove physical things, I mean, we're all driving in nice cars, we don't have to walk that much anywhere, but doesn't that other bring other problems? So where people were there were just scrapping together to try not to starve, we have people who have too much. And when you have too much, you look for ways to entertain yourself. So you start taking drugs. And then you start thinking, and you start having affairs. And then you start thinking, I need something to make my life meaningful. And if you can't find it in something external out here, you just get more stuff. So we get so much stuff that we don't need. Just try to find a way of entertaining ourselves because we think maybe if I get that, I'll be happy. But the only thing that makes us happy is that portion of ourselves that is deep. And that's the healing. The healing isn't about the body or the mind. When Jesus said, "Thy faith has made thee whole," what did he do? He made that person understand that they were whole. It wasn't about the leprosy. It was about the spirit from the inside out, that he was whole to begin with. And when we go into our place of solitude, when we go into that place and just try to remember the presence of God, even for 5 minutes, even for 10 minutes, we will come out from that place of strength with our battery charged. And then with that knowledge of the light of God in our hearts, then when we meet other people, we can try to remember if the light of God is in my heart, it is in your heart, it's in your heart, it's in every human being that I encounter. So that when we run into people that give us pain or that give us a problem, if we can only remember that person has the temple of God in their hearts, let me remember that. Let me remember that person is a child of God. Even if that person has treated me very badly, maybe there's something that I need to learn from this. Maybe it's actually my ego that's getting in the way. Now, by ego, I'm not saying that we should be doormats. No. Being spiritual is not about being a doormat. It's not about people riding over you. We have to be truthful, but we have to be kind. And if people are treating us badly, then we can say so in a way that is not hurtful or angry. Because whenever we do things that are hurtful and angry, what we do is make little things in here, create little impressions in our mind. And there's a word for that, but I won't bother you with it. With every angry thought, with every greedy thought, with every self-centered thought, we make a little groove in our minds. It's like our minds are very soft and plastic. So we create this groove, and the more, let's say, we get angry a second time, we make the groove deeper. Get angry a third time, it gets deeper. So what happens is that we create habits of thinking. So we actually create in our mind either an angry mind or a kind mind. No one has done it to us. It's not our genes. We've done it to ourselves. We instinctively, you know, we create a mind by instinctively reacting in a certain way. So we think it's our who we are. Well, that's who I am. Well, change it. It's your mind. It's no one else's. If you can't change your mind, who else is going to do it for you? Don't take a pill. Fix it. Which is sort of the beauty of the Hindu traditions, because it doesn't blame anybody. There's no God or no devil to say, you made me do it. Mm-hmm. Devil made me do it. No. At some point, there's kind of a click over where you feel something building over. I'm going to say something. I'm going to react. I got mad. I'm justified. Nothing is satisfying as self-righteous indignation. But what happens is that we actually create a mental environment that's quite painful for ourselves by creating a mind that's angry. We could choose to say, I'm not going to react. I'm just going to, you know, think about this and say something when I'm not feeling this way. We can also create a greedy mind by saying, I should have that. This person wants it, but I should have it. It's like, what? Maybe giving this to someone else would bring them joy. Don't we feel happier when we give presents rather than when we get them? Life is a big present. Life is like a present, like, I've got to go there, therefore I'm not going to let this person in the lane. Does it really take that much time to let someone get ahead of us? Or are we just saying, you don't know who I am, I've got to get there, I'm important, I've got to go there first. It's all about, it's not the big things that get in the news press that make us who we are. It's the small things. It's the small things that build our character. It's habits of thought that create habits of our character. Character is who we are. If you find a person who can't resist taking money from money from the firm, it's because they've created a habit of greed in their minds. It wasn't like some sudden impulse. It's like they have a habit of thinking this way. If you find a person who, by nature, you love being with that person because they're so kind, it's a habit of thinking of things in a kind way. So we all have that opportunity to follow the path of Jesus Christ. He made it available for the entire world through his life, through his teachings, through Abba. Abba, what Jesus did for the world is take God out of the rule books and make him into the most intimate relationship in the world. There is nothing more wonderful than when you see a child run to the father going, Daddy, 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 Daddy. And the child picking up, and the father picking up the child said, oh, I'm so happy you're here. And that's the way we need to go to our silence and solitude. That it's like a tryst with God. You know, like when we were young with our boyfriends and girlfriends, and I'll see you there at 4 o'clock, okay? And the way that we can hardly wait for the time to be there, that's the way we need to approach being in silence with God, because God is our nearest and dearest. Abba is the closest, the most intimate relationship we have. And we come from that place, when we come from that place of the fullness of God in our hearts, then we are healed even if we don't have an arm, even if we have MS, even if we have Parkinson's, even if we have cancer, even if we are dying as we're sitting here right now, even if we have done something terrible, because no matter what we have done, we always have the opportunity to say, Lord, I am so sorry I did that. Please, I ask you for the strength to never do that again. And I know you will give me that strength, because I will keep trying to remember you, Lord, before I try to think of myself. And that gives us the strength to come from that place of not only being healed ourselves, but being able to offer ourselves in service to others. Because we can't really help other people until we ourselves come from that place of strength, of our batteries being charged, of looking upon others as manifestations of a divinity, of loving our neighbor as ourselves, until we ourselves come from that place of the fullness of God. So I think this is about coffee time, isn't it, Alice? I'm a believer.